You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
Of new writing in our lobby. I'm sure there are others of you in the room beside myself who have an entire shelf dedicated to issues of Granta in your house. Anyone here want to confess to that? Okay, the Grantaites are here. Not only am I a longtime fan and reader of Granta, but I've been really impressed by how these Granta folks can keep a secret. We have been planning to do this evening for almost 6 months now, and we did not know who the authors would be until just last week. It's been classified. So bravo to Granta, bravo to the new Best of Young British Novelists, and I'd also like to give a deep thanks to the British Council, which has helped to promote this Granta list and this events and others like it in this country and abroad. I also want to acknowledge, as we begin tonight, that photo I saw in the paper this week of the start of the London Marathon. Those runners standing silent in solidarity with those who ran in the Boston Marathon. And in that silent moment, I felt like I could really feel the links between our two countries. Every 10 years since 1983, the London-based literary magazine Granta names the 20 writers it considers the best of the young British novelists. And this list has come to be regarded as a bellwether in the literary world, since so many of the writers singled out at that early stage in their career, starting with Martin Amis, Pat Barker, and Salman Rushdie, have gone on to great commercial and critical success. It serves, as the New York Times noted, as a kind of advanced talent detection system. The new list from Granta is likely to generate an animated discussion about what it means to be British in the 21st century. Tonight, we welcome two of the novelists, Nadifa Mohammed and Ross Raisin, as well as John Freeman, Granta's editor, who served on the 7-member panel that selected the novelists. John will tell you more about the list. He'll introduce our two young best and already very accomplished novelists tonight. John, by the way, is also a poet and critic, and he himself is the author of two books, The Tyranny of Email and How to Read a Novelist, which is coming out this fall. And between 2006 and 2008, he served as president of the National Book Critics Circle and currently teaches at Columbia and City University of New York. Please join me in welcoming John Freeman, Nadifa Mohammed, and Ross Raisin to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. My name is John Freeman. Thank you, Louise, for that introduction, and thank you to the library for hosting us in such style. I was backstage when she asked about the Granta. So, how many people here are Grantaites? And okay, the rapture begins. We can all go to the spaceship. The rest of you have to stay in California. Not such a bad thing. I'm actually from California, so it's really nice to be back here. And it's really nice to be back here with these two writers. They are sort of the end of a road for us. We began 2 years ago to make this list and began reading around in young British writers. We did a kind of a warm-up for this in an issue we called Britain, themed to Britain, and we put out a call to submissions to about 150 different British writers. And it was a way for us to get more up to speed of young British writers. And then when it came to doing this issue, we selected a jury, and I wish they could be here with me. I simply was on the jury and guided the discussion, but the six other people on this jury were instrumental to not just Ross and Adifa's selection. And, you know, we've been very lucky over the years in that our jury members are not just book critics and teachers. You know, Salman Rushdie was a jury member when he was living under the fatwa. Hilary Mantel, before she won two Booker Prizes, was a jury member. Spyatt. This year we had A.L. Kennedy, the Scottish novelist, Sigrid Rousing, the publisher of the magazine, Romesh Ganasekara, who's a wonderful novelist. If you're a fan of Michael Ondaatje and you're annoyed that he publishes so infrequently, you have a guy who publishes every 3 years and writes a lot like him, and is very, very good. Check him out. Ella Offrey, the deputy of the magazine, and then two book editors, Stuart Kelly, who's at The Scotsman, and Gabby Wood, who's at The Observer, actually The Telegraph. And we had a spirited discussion. We read over 150 writers. This took us over 9 months. We winnowed it down to about 35 to a long list, and then went into the last meeting with gloves off. But it's very nice to have that kind of discussion about books, because so often the discussion about books happens in print, in newsprint, in the critical space, and in my experience in that realm, it's not always fair. You know, you look at who reviews books. Most of them, at least in England, are white. A lot of them are men, and they don't leave. They're in that job like Supreme Court justices. And so this issue of Granta is a bit like a velvet hammer, you know, to try to get our critical discussion of the novel up with the times. And Adifa said something really beautiful the other day. She said, you guys basically found what was there. And that's what our job was, is to find what was happening right in front of us, to clear out all the noise. And I think this list does that in a lot of different ways. In addition to Ross and Adifa, there are 18 other writers, and their backgrounds are quite diverse. But also the language they use is quite diverse. There are high stylists. There are satirical writers. There are very, very funny writers. There are writers who sound, Benjamin Markowitz sounds like a combination of A.S. Byatt and Richard Ford. He's very worth checking out. Taya Selassie has written her first novel, and she's in some ways rewriting the way that an African novel can sound. They're very exciting, and they're at the lip, I think, of what language is doing. And where storytelling is going. And one of the reasons that Granta exists is that when it was relaunched in 1979 by Bill Buford and Jonathan Levy, two Americans at Cambridge on Fulbrights, was to shake up the British literary establishment and to try to inject some energy into the literary world there, which was at that time very wedded to realism and chronicling the sort of slow decline of the empire. Well, it's still declining, but... In other ways, the British, I find this is a very exciting moment for British writing, and these two guys are a perfect example of that. Nadifa is the author of two novels, Black Mama Boy, which I could summarize just as the Odyssey set in Africa, with all that grand epics, peregrinations, the confrontations, the wandering, the violence, and it starts in Yemen in 1935 and winds up in Hull on almost the contemporary day. And it was based on the life of her father, who we'll talk about a little later. Extraordinary book. Her new book, The Orchard of Lost Souls, is a huge leap forward in many ways. It's told from three different perspectives, three women who were watching the fall of Somalia in 1988 during a revolution. It is a beautiful novel. It is, in some ways, I think, sorry, I'm going to do lots of metaphors. This is the L.A. part of me. Sun Also Rises, set in her hometown. I don't know. You'll see it when she reads from it. Ross is a wonderful writer who writes kind of sprung poetry. His first novel, God's Own Country, this is the U.K. book, so if you go looking for it, it won't look like this. But it'll still be the same book. And it's about a 19-year-old boy who gets kicked out of school and winds up on his family sheep farm, obsessed with a girl. And it's told in his deeply refracted, musical Yorkshire voice. And over the course of the novel, he starts to lose his faculties. His second novel, Waterline, tells the story of a man whose wife dies of cancer. He goes from Glasgow to London to work in a hotel and winds up homeless. It is a beautiful novel about the way people fall through the cracks in society in contemporary Britain. They've both contributed pieces to the issue. Part of Nadifa's new novel is in it, and Ross has a short story. They are magical writers. Please join me in welcoming them. So why don't you tell me, to start with, where is it that you're from, and how do you describe it to people?
I'm from Yorkshire, and it's God's own country. It depends who you're talking to, I think, doesn't it? I think if I'm talking to people from Yorkshire, I tell them I'm from Yorkshire. If I'm talking to people from... No, I'd always say from Yorkshire, actually. But I think I have I don't know, I suppose in terms of the list, I would probably be one of the people who is quite solidly and stolidly British compared to certainly the exotics as they've been called. But I think that actually I have quite a complicated, often troubled sense of home that probably does come into my writing. Actually, I always say that my writing is quite other than me. Like the young sheep farmer or the homeless Glaswegian guy, and now I'm writing a book about a gay footballer. And they are, it's very outside of my own experience, all of those things, but I think that part of the reason why I always seem to be writing about people who are in some way searching for or unsure of what home is, there's a lot of fleeing in my novels, is to do with the fact that I'm not quite sure myself. I'm a Yorkshire person, but I live down south, which is in some ways quite troubling. And but I would say...
Do you get a lot of flack from that when you go home?
Well, yeah, you get ribbed. And certainly you change your accent depending on where you are. I change it greatly when I go back home and watch a football match and feel like a fraud. I feel like a fraud, I think, wherever I am, and I think that's my inside troubled self, I think, yeah.
Do you have a complicated sense of home like that?
Yeah, definitely. I was born in Somalia, raised in England, and I think both whenever I go to Somalia and being in London, people always kind of treat you as if you're not a real British person or a Somali person. So only now have I really started to feel like Britain is my home, and it's kind of a conscious choice. And I think one of the reasons that prevented me feeling as if Britain was my home was the fact that I left a home kind of suddenly and without having any say in the matter. My father brought us to England where he lived because he knew that the situation was getting very bad in Somalia and wanted us to be safe. But I'd left my family, I'd left my grandmother's, my friends, my home, and it always felt as if the natural thing was to return, especially as the situation just seemed to get worse and worse and worse in Somalia. So the desire to return, I think, kind of increased with that, and the sense of loyalty and guilt that you'd left the people that you loved. So now it's improving a lot, and my grandmother's are not there anymore, so it feels as if it's a place I'm connected to, but I don't feel as much responsibility for or connection to in some ways. Mm. While London is what I really know, especially my corner of London, that's my real home. I can walk around it almost blindfolded and I'll know where I am, and I know what it's like in the spring, I know what it's like in the summer, and that's really important.
Your novels seem to me in some ways to be about arrival, but this documentary that you're making is about return. I wonder why that is, when you switched to a different medium, you thought that way.
I'm not sure. I was asked to come work on this documentary project called Return to Somalia. I'm from the northern part of Somalia, which broke away about 20 years ago to become Somaliland, and it's very peaceful and developing in a good way. Southern Somalia, which most people know about, it's Mogadishu, it's where Black Hawk Down happened and all those sorts of things, that's had a much more troubled history. And only in the last year or so have things finally calmed down and people are able to return and rebuild their homes and set up businesses and see their family members again. So it was a really interesting moment to capture. People didn't know how long it would last. Well, they've had lulls in the fighting before, but this seemed to be a lull that just, you know, carried on and on. And we found two groups of people. One is a girl who was born in Washington, D.C., and she's a hip-hop promoter. And she swaggers into Mogadishu and tries to change things. And then there are two young men who live in London who are much more Somali. They left when they were about 13, 14 and have always wanted to return and took this immediate opportunity, even though it was very risky for them. They want to set up a movement called the anti-tribalism movement in Somalia. So that's very political and they would easily become targets. But, you know, they have this kind of Gandhian motivation. They really want to make sure that Somalia is a different country to what it's been in the past.
Ross, in God's Own Country, one of the ongoing threads is the encroaching development of the town that your character lives in. The Fat Betty, the pub, has been bought by a chain, and there's a petition going around to be signed by people. Your main character is kind of patrolling his field, looking at all the tourists coming in. Is this an issue that is ongoing in Yorkshire, that is, you know, second home people and the south creeping north, that in some ways threatens the identity of Yorkshire, or do you feel like that's more his paranoia as a character?
I don't think it's just Yorkshire. I think that's across the UK. That's all of the beautiful places have that kind of encroachment going on. That's not a new thing. I mean, that's I suppose particularly Yorkshire, Wales, Cornwall, Scotland. Mm. But it's most of those places. They have their identity, and they've kept their identity, but it's. And I don't think that's particularly under threat. I think more under threat is the way of life of the people. Certainly economically is a big thing. So in the place where the book is set, well, it's set in a slightly fictionalised place, but it's North Yorkshire, and it's a place where... So it's like a typical village, like a farming village, where a lot of second homeowners have come, but they don't live there the whole time. They only live there when it's... The weather's nice, so they live there for about 2 weeks of the year. But the rest of the time, they're in London. And, you know, in a sense, that's fine, but it's not really fine because the house prices go up and the local people who service the place, they're forced to live further away. And also that just some of the traditional ways of life there, they're I don't know if under attack is the right way of putting it, but they're being undermined. Like I did a... When I was doing my research and I was talking to farmers, I particularly remember one farm that I went to. I talked to a farmer and he was saying that his farm was on one side of this town, and his fields, or quite a big part of his fields, were on the other side of the town. So he used to run his cattle through the town. It was like one road through it, and some of the off-comered ones is the term for them, the off-comered people. They got up a petition to get him to stop doing that, which they failed with, obviously. And he was quite disparaging of them. Bloody clowns, they were, which they are. But I think as long as they're buffoons and they're kind of comic, that's fine. It's when they actually start to change the ways that people live in, that's when it becomes not fine.
It feels like in the language that your character uses, there's a kind of violence to the language. That feels mirrored by the violence of the landscape. Is that something that you feel, and when you go back home, or is this something that you've amplified for the purposes of literature?
Amplified, certainly. I think I'm very interested in landscape and the personal relationship of an individual's relationship with landscape, and so that comes into all my work. Actually, I think certainly in that first book. For that main character, landscape is a way of engaging with the world. He can't really engage with the human world, but he engages with the landscape. Landscape is an ally, I suppose, to him. It's a way of seeing and feeling the world that he can't really do in human terms. And even that's this short story, actually, landscape is a way of understanding the world for the narrator. It's a way of in some ways, actually, it's a medium for memory, is feeling that memory through landscape.
Do you want to read just the two paragraphs from the book?
Yeah. Just sit here to do that? Or just, like, stand up, walk around?
Yeah.
I'll do it from here. I'm quite comfortable now, so this is just short. I have to just run a little practice line in my head when I each of my books, they seem to be in these particular vernaculars, and I've not done this for a little while, so I just do this particular sentence. I kept to the moors after that. Each afternoon when I'd filled troughs up or whatever else Father had said, I'd fetch the whelps and go up. I felt peaceable there. Once I reached the brow where the moors lashed out, a million miles of heather and gorse and rock, but not a person in sight. The whelps were small enough still I could take them up in the wheelbarrow, though I let Sal ride on my shoulder. She lay there, serious as a soldier, scanning over the land, until I set her down with the others, and spriggets of heather towered over them like giant bloody oaks where they gadabouted round. I could stay up there a stack of hours, lost with myself, nothing to bother me but the slap of wind on my chops, time slowly emptying all thought out my body till I was light as lamb's wool, except for her, niggling at my senses. I kept playing the time outside the window when she'd said, "Who was the farmer, Dad?" Only each time I heard her say it, I got her voice mixed up with a lass off some television programme about her school, even though her voice was nothing similar, far as I could remember. It was daft stewing on a girl like that. I tried to shove her to the back of my skull. Do you understand a word of that?
Oh, it's quite extraordinary when you read the book. It's one of those books that you actually have to read aloud in your head in order to read it. But once you actually slow down and do that, it's like music. Nadifa, you've also written about a young character, not quite as younger than Ross's.
Mm-hmm.
What is the appeal of writing about a child? Are there benefits to it? Are they allowed to see things?
I think so. I think I'm kind of obsessed with kids. I've got lots of children in my family, and they're so raw and malleable that I think that they give you an insight into what people really are, who we really are, and especially street kids, because I think like Rousseau wanted children to be brought up kind of feral, and that's how you see the real character. And in my second novel as well, there's a street girl who runs away from the refugee camp or the orphanage that she's brought up in the refugee camp and lives in this ditch, this kind of, you know, wilderness in the middle of town. And I just love the idea of this child bringing themselves up, you know, opening their eyes to the world, and their experiences are what forms them rather than... I've lived a very structured life, very safe life. And in a sense, I don't know what I'm fully capable of because of that.
Mm.
And with children who are living in much more kind of extreme circumstances, they really do know what they're capable of.
You studied politics and history at Oxford, so you're quite a bit smarter than me. did you learn at Oxford the skills to read your own family's personal past? Or were you studying English history or other?
Yeah, it was all English history. I did one... course on early Islamic history and late Byzantine history, but that was the only kind of non-British thing I did. What I think I got from studying history particularly was stories.
Mm.
It's the same as in English literature. I'm interested in stories and the fact that these stories are kind of manipulated to become mythologies for states, for nations. That's really interesting. So Somalis, we've had an incredibly intense last 100 years. Things have changed so rapidly, for good and for worse, that there's not been any time to reflect, really. And there's probably more research on the English Civil War than there has been on the Somali Civil War. And I find that really disturbing. And all I can do is take these stories that I hear about, my father's, my mother's, you know, the people around me, and try and use them as a way of also record-keeping.
How does that work, though, when you're basically writing about a character who, in some ways, is the childhood version of your father?
Yeah.
There must be days where you have to kind of push it away.
Yeah, it was really hard, and it was really hard, actually. My father's ancient. He's 88 now. And
careful, there might be someone that age here.
Sorry. He is ancient, and... There's a sense that I didn't really know him before I started writing about him. We've become friends in that time. And knowing what he went through, and even now he tells me things I find really upsetting. So I had to almost kind of control what I was going to write about because it's really powerful. And he is the same boy. I can see now when he's struggling with health problems, the kind of spirit that kept him going through the Second World War or through, you know, massive hardships that he endured as a child. He hasn't changed that much.
Do you want to read a section? This is actually a different one than I asked you last time. It starts at Jama walked and walked. It's just a long paragraph.
Okay. Jama walked and walked. No more cars or lorries passed by, and he didn't see any camel caravans. But he carried on stubbornly. The clouds pursued him, gathering in speed and strength, an army dressed in black marching across the sky, conquering the blue. Straight ahead of him, the sun got heavier and larger, like a hot old lady wobbling before her knees finally buckled. He reached the ruined Oromo town, its once grand buildings fallen down and forgotten. Jarmuk crept into the old mosque, the wood rotting and the clay bricks disintegrating around him. He rested on his haunches and sat there like a madman amid the dirt and debris, bats flitting in and out of the silent pulpit and spirits murmuring behind his back. He watched as the wind blew life into an old snakeskin and it slithered away to find its old self. Thirsty and frightened, he regretted running away and was now tempted to return to Jinno. He found a well and peered into its gloomy mouth. He suspected it was full of rubbish, twigs, rubble, a dead rat, but he was so thirsty he dropped a rock and heard the delicious reply of water. Jarmuk leaned further over the lip of the well. The old wall crumbled underneath him and he fell headfirst into the stinking pit. He spat and blew his nose, but the bitter water had already gone down his throat. He scrambled out, terrified the whole thing would collapse on him, and went back despondently to the ghost mosque, with scratched arms and a vile taste in his mouth. Only when his mother's sleeping body appeared beside him, her ribs rising and falling in peaceful slumber, could he finally close his eyes. At the darkest hour of night, the sky cracked and revealed a blue and white secret, revealed a blue and white secret kingdom. The high heavens and low earth were joined by a sheet of conquering raindrops, followed by a thundering marching band that seemed to be playing drums, cymbals, violins, and reedy flutes, whose notes fell down and smashed against the gasping desert earth, battering down an angry song of life. Jarmuk was awoken by this miraculous concert heralding the end of the dry season, and sleepily turned onto his back to receive his benediction. Rain splattered against his lips, and he opened his mouth to drink it in. He heard happy laughter echoing around him, and saw drenched jinns cavorting and dancing with abandon.
That's just one paragraph. We've been talking about your first books. Both of your books were shortlisted for the Guardian First Book Prize. You got a lot of attention and good reviews, interviews, other awards. What was it like when you were in the middle of that and working on your second books? Were there things both of you wanted to avoid and not repeat? Because both of you have written books where it's the kind of thing that people would say, how do you repeat that? And actually, can you just give us more of the same?
I think it's difficult to answer because you know how you want to answer it. And you want it to be true. It's sometimes difficult to know whether actually that's just the party line that you've set yourself. But I believe my party line, and it's that I really don't. Well, I do care. Yeah, I do. I do care about the external world, but I don't think it influences my writing at all. I think I think that just the forces that come to bear when you're actually writing a book, the forces that come from yourself are just so strong. You just can't. Nothing else can really can match them. And when I started writing my second book, I did feel the pressure from myself, but I think it was more a pressure, not that people expected a certain thing or that it had to be good because I had a contract for it or people expected it to be good. I think more just I just felt really fortunate that I'd got myself into a position where potentially for the next little slot of my life I can write books, which is what I wanted to do. But then that brings a pressure with it because it's like, well, if you are now a published writer and you can have a career of whatever length, then you better bloody well enjoy it because I know I've got really good friends who've not been as fortunate as that and they've not got published and they're not able to write because they can't afford to. And so I felt this kind of compulsion to just enjoy it. You should be enjoying this. You've got the whole day. You can spend the whole day writing this first draft. And I think the thing that I've probably learned over the last 10 years of writing is that I don't always enjoy it, but that's okay. I think there's parts of the process that I enjoy greatly, and there's other parts, first drafting, mainly just first drafting, really, which I hate, and I find it really a struggle. And in the course of a novel, I'll probably take a year doing that. And so I think I just have to accept that I'm going to spend a year being pretty unhappy. I'm in the middle of it right now, actually. I'm about 60,000 words into a novel, and it's been hard work. Not quite as hard work as the second one, but actually, also in hindsight, I think the second one's just quite a depressing book. It's about bereavement, and it's about the death of industry, and it's about a man who falls apart from his family, and he becomes homeless, and it's not cheery. So, and I never wanted the experience to be in any way cheery for the reader. So, of course,
but he finds love in the end, right?
He finds. Well, you can say, yeah, go on then. Yeah, he finds love in the form of yeah.
What about you? How was this?
I found it evil. I think writing my second book was evil, and I nearly gave up. And I went the first year after my, well, the year my book was published was just a whirlwind. I travelled around a lot and met millions of people and talked about my book to death. And so I was kind of happy to stop and to reach kind of more internal space again. But I think that's just a shock to the system. And I'd written my first book by accident almost, bit by bit, working on it and then stopping and working on it again. And it was this very personal thing with my father. And I knew I wasn't going to repeat that. It wasn't going to be a second version of Black Mamba Boy. But what I did choose ended up being really emotionally taxing. It was quite depressing as well. And it's set in Somalia during the dictatorship and the beginning of the civil war. So I had to kind of look back on what that was like for my family and for other people. And it was really hard. It was really hard.
Is this
hard.
Second book more of your mother's story?
Partly. So I began the process by interviewing her. And she'd seen the British leave in the late 50s and the Somali flag go up for the first time, and it was very exciting, and they really, like, Somali was a model for African democracy for a while, and then the dictatorship kind of came in, and it was fine, you know, they introduced some good policies, they shut the schools 1 year so that anyone who could read could teach illiterate people how to read, and the literacy rate shot up, so lots of good things were happening. And then there was the war with Ethiopia in 1977, and that kind of was like something turned then. Switch turned, and eventually the dictatorship put all of its energy into crushing its own people. Very similar to what's going on now in Syria. And it's heavy. I was there for the first 4 years of my life, and you know, I kind of remember the fear and the paranoia of that time. So I was uncovering all those different layers of my own experience, my family's experience, cooped up in a little room, unable to go out because I was so kind of like stressed by the process of writing to a schedule, which I had never done before. So it's not a process I want to repeat again. I'm going to do it differently next time.
Well, now that it's done, do you want to read the section of it that appears in Granta?
So this is from one of the later chapters in my book. It's about a character called Filson. She's a female soldier in the Somali army. She's moved from the capital, Mogadishu, to Hargeisa, which is the second city where I was born, to suppress a rebellion that's brewing in the north. And on this particular day, she's very excited because she's taking part in an action to destroy water reservoirs that are apparently being used by the local rebels. It is a tula, barely even a village. A few beehive-shaped dwellings with old cloth hanging from their entrances. A tea shop with kettles resting on open fires. One solitary stone building with a tin roof. Goats, stray children, a cleared space under a tall tree for religious lessons and clan meetings. The elders have been summoned, and Filson remembers her role in this theatre. She steps forward to intercept the three men, but they ignore her and carry on with their sticks and bandy legs to a conscript behind. She grabs the man on the right by the arm. Jali, it is me you need to speak with. He is a thin, wiry man, but he shakes her off with surprising force. Filson pursues, not willing to ask for anyone's assistance in dealing with him. She wants to drag him back by the long tufts of grey hair skirting his bald pate and make him kneel at her feet. She catches up with him and shoves the barrel of her gun in the small of his back. Stop. He freezes and turns slowly to face her. She withdraws the rifle but holds it tightly, still aimed in his direction. My commander has delegated me to speak with you. We are here with the full authority of the revolutionary government. There is strong evidence that you have been assisting the outlawed national freedom movement, and to prevent further collaboration, the barricades surrounding this settlement will be destroyed. Filson speaks in a rush, not stopping to breathe. You are still entitled to use your traditional drop wells and will be supplied with supplementary water once a month by the local government. The whole village now seems to have crowded around her. The other soldiers have disappeared into the shacks. This is government land. Filson raises her voice and gestures to the expanse beyond them. And you do not even deny that you used the barricades to support the terrorists. The third elder, younger than the other two, and still possessing a full head of black hair, joins the conversation. Jale, he says mockingly, we use those barricades to water our camels, our goats and sheep, to perform ablutions before prayers, for a cup of tea in the mornings. We have nothing to spare for anything else. We are in the middle of a long drought. Do you think we would give water to rebels? And then a huge plume of water, mud and stone flies into the sky to the west of the village, the bellow of the dynamite echoing against the limestone hills. The villagers run towards the explosions, the elders in the lead, children yelping in excitement and fear behind them. Filson catches up with the crowd just as Lieutenant Afrah orders the final detonation. The rectangular cement walls of the nearest barricade have been blown into fragments, and fresh water glides over the parched, eroded earth and slips quietly into deep cracks on the surface. The destruction silences the elders, but she can sense their anger in the same way she had learned to read her father's. The set of their jaws, the tension in their shoulders, their bodies angled away from the subject of their hate. The commandos begin to filter into view, smiling and relaxed, unconcerned by the reaction of the villagers. These kinds of raids are welcome to them, bringing minimal risk and potential loot. Filson pants after her chase and presses her palm against the stitch in her ribs. The villagers are rooted to the soil, their heads turning from crater to crater, false rain dripping from the acacias. She marches towards the elders, intending to explain the necessity of the action, the benefits they could enjoy if they only shunned the rebels, the projects that they might partake in to diversify the local economy. The red-haired elder swivels at her approach and swings his cane at her face. She doesn't notice her finger squeeze the trigger of her rifle as her whole body recoils from the blow. The knock of the rifle against her chest surprises her, as does the sudden pop of bullets. When the elder falls onto his behind, she assumes that he has lost his balance trying to strike her, until points of blood spring up over his shirt, turning the white cloth a red that darkens before her eyes. Then the two other elders decide to drop to the ground too, their open eyes still watching her. Movements at the periphery of her vision are blurred, so she does not recognize the grey shadows as her comrades advancing on the prostrate men. Hold fire, shouts Lieutenant Afrah. Filson looks down at her feet and sees bronze beetles scuttling over them. She presses one boot on the other, and the beetles are stilled, transformed into empty bullet shells. The elders are slumped over each other like drunks. A howl sweeps over the plain as first one woman, and then another, rushes to the dead and dying bodies. Filson tries to step forward, but her boots feel cemented down. Lieutenant Afrah aims his Kalashnikov at the young men in the crowd. Get back! 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 A group of soldiers corner the youths and force them back to the cleared space at the center of the threadbare settlement. Filson notices for the first time how thin their calves are, just shafts of bone below their frayed sarongs. They are hustled away, hands on the back of their afros, to squat in the sun until the soldiers depart. An old woman pulls the wives off the corpses and shrouds the men's faces under a shawl.
She says nothing, but turns to Filson and points a finger. Whether it is to lay blame, mark her out of retribution, or curse her, Filson cannot decipher. Get in the truck, Jale. We will secure the area, Lieutenant Afrah orders. Filson peers down at her distant boots. But I can't move. Afrah clicks his fingers and a conscript no older than 15 comes to his side. Escort her back to the truck. The conscript takes her elbow gently, like he would with his grandmother, and leads her forward as she stumbles over the broken ground. You did well, Jale, he keeps repeating in her ear as they trek the half mile back to the vehicles. But what happened? Who killed them? She whispers. Thank you.
I think I've read that passage about 20 times as we were editing it, and I've heard you read it several times. And it's always extraordinary to me about how well you describe something very violent happening and seeming otherworldly.
Mm-hmm. I read too many violent things. I think it comes out in my writing, too.
Yeah. I want to... Ross, you're working on a book about a footballer, and I presume at some point there must be a stretch of action where you have to describe what it's like to be in the middle of a football game.
Well, it's a good question. I'm slightly undecided as to whether I'm going to do that or not. But I am going to do that. Yeah, I think... I'm at the moment in California, which is nice. But when I'm back home in a few days, I will resume a set piece that's probably going to go somewhere in the middle of the book that, does have quite a detailed examination of a match. But I don't know whether I'll keep it or not. I don't know. It depends whether I want to alienate a large part of the readership or not. Yeah. Well, Ian McEwan had a 14-page squash scene in Saturday.
So that did go on for a bit.
Yeah.
But it was squash.
I think it'd be probably better without that.
It's not the great game. But in the story that you have in our issue, there's also it's a very strange story, and it's quite odd.
Yeah.
It's sort of otherworldly, apocalyptic, and but lots of things are happening. Is that something new for you? Because both of your books are very internal in different ways.
Yeah, it is new. It's different for me, actually. But I was saying to you last night that one of the enjoyments I have in writing short stories is that I feel the ability to experiment stylistically and with form and with language. And that's certainly something I'm doing in this. But at the same time, I'm still tagged back by the things that envelop me and obsess me, I suppose, and interest me. And actually, I wrote this short story. In fact, I wrote this short story probably shortly after finishing my last novel. And my last novel is largely about grief. And I'd been thinking about grief and the fictional process of representing it through this main character for a long time. And this novel is also this short story is also about grief. But I think I wanted, I obviously felt a need to write about it in a different way. And this is a very different way of writing about grief. One of the things that when I was writing that novel, the one about the homeless man, that was quite prevalent and became something that I got quite involved in is the subject of missing people. And in fact, I got involved with the Missing People Charity in the UK. And the term for the kind of grief that people experience when a loved one goes missing is often called ambiguous loss, which is to say that the person is physically absent but psychologically present. The flip side of that is perhaps when people suffer dementia and things like that, when it's the other way around, and so they're physically present but psychologically absent. And people, they grieve, but they grieve in a very atypical way. And they're kind of all over the place between hope and hopelessness and anger, guilt. And there's a type of loss in this short story that is also atypical. And I think that the effect of that is a distortion, a subversion of memory on the part of the narrator, which is kind of what makes it a bit of an odd story, actually. It's a strange read.
It's haunting. Well, would you read from it?
Yeah.
Is the book still open?
Now, I'm going to do the thing here. I saw the guy doing it. Yeah. It's good, isn't it? It actually came about, this short story, from something I developed in my school group. I do a school group in London, and I have a group of about 12, 15 teenagers. And it's a creative writing group. I meet them once a week. And I set them exercises, I set them things to do during the session. And I did used to do it, that I'd set them the exercise and they'd get writing and I would go around and I'd help them and I'd advise them on certain things. But they quite quickly were like, well, so what, you want us to write this and then you want us to read it out as a group, but you're not going to do anything. You're not going to write yourself and read it out. And so they made it that I had to do that. So I can't remember what I'd set them for this particular thing. I think I probably asked them to write a visually arresting scene, something like that. And I wrote a snippet myself, which I kept. I keep all those fragments that I write in those sessions because they're actually quite good material for me. And from that, this story came. It's called Subversion. It comes back in different ways, but this more than any other. We're out of town, drinking in an empty beachside bar in a small resort down by the coast. The season is pretty much at an end, the bar owner tells us. That's why it's so quiet. I smile politely. Your face is turned away towards the little television set, skewered into a roof beam among old postcards and fading paper garlands. The rain has started up again. It taps and dribbles on the low corrugated roof. This has been a bumper season, the bar owner is saying, owing to the drought. The tourists have come in record numbers to lie on the beach and trek through the forest up to the fertility monument. The governor and his wife were down here for a whole 2 weeks. A teenage boy died in a jet ski accident. Look, you say then, your eyes still on the television. There are always warnings, every year at around this time. Not that anybody ever takes much notice. If it floods, it floods, is the attitude we have always taken. The previous year the rains came late and released a rare brief joy through our town. Morris Peak danced in the square. Groups of children ran down to the swollen river to play and smoke and cut channels into Van Stierman's soft wet fields. When the banks overflowed, Van Stierman's fields, as they always did, turned into a glistening brown swamp, his parsnips floating up to the surface as pale and bloated as baby's limbs. If it floods, it floods. But we've never before known anything like this. The bar owner and I turn to look with you at the television. It shows a moving aerial view of our town, or rather, the highest parts of it, the rest being underwater. At this stage, the head of the rusted cow above the sail yard is still visible, collapsed wooden stalls bobbing all around it. There are people gathered on the roof of the town hall and the hotel, and somebody is clinging, spread-eagled, to the side of the church steeple. It doesn't look to me like the vicar, but it's difficult to tell, never having seen him in that position before. The view moves over the town to the outskirts, and I notice with some surprise that a tattered Give Them the Boot banner covers most of the Morton's garage roof. It is weighted down with large rocks, as if they've long been expecting the cameras. You know that place? The bar owner asks. Yes, you say. We live there. I think he gives you a peculiar look at that point, although I can't be sure. The rain begins to pelt harder onto the roof. A dog, which has been asleep on the sand just inside the bar's entrance, walks over as if to join us in front of the television, but instead picks up a gristle of meat from underneath one of the bar stools and slumps onto the floor to chew at it. A feeling of quiet shame comes over me as I watch these images. Here is our town, on national television, a place where people store their junk, fridges, tyres, broken televisions, on their garage roofs. The vandalized statue in the town square has never been fixed. In desperation, the townspeople are now massing together on top of the dirty buildings, jumping and gesticulating at the helicopter. The drought that has lasted all through the spring and summer finally ended yesterday, according to the rolling news at the bottom of the screen. The rains intensified overnight, and at around 10 o'clock this morning, the river broke its banks. By 11 o'clock, all low-lying areas of the town were inundated with floodwater. The famous sail yards building, despite a sandbag barricade, has fallen apart. So too the post office, the old prison, and all the rest of the older wooden structures along the high street. The town hall, however, built from the thick grey stone mined further down the valley, and the supermarket, are still standing strong. "Bloody hell," the bar owner mutters. "Bloody hell." You don't say anything. You simply watch and drink occasionally from your beer, the leathery red scars on your forearms clearly visible beneath, below the short sleeves of your shirt. A telephone rings in the back room and the bar owner goes to answer it, and it is at this moment I can hear distinctly the excited pitch of the news reporter's voice that he appears. The helicopter camera has panned down and is following an object that at first looks like some kind of dark box, but as the image grows closer, I see that it is in fact our father, asleep in his armchair, drifting down the high street. Instinctively, I turn towards you, and for a single moment you look away from the television, at me, with an expression not of shock or confusion, but rather, as I instantly take it to mean, of accusation. Our father is drifting now past the barbershop, recognisable only because the top of its pole is protruding from the water. His chair must then snag onto something beneath the surface, because it stops for a few seconds, stuck, tugging, as the image holds still and a familiar nausea begins to rise in my throat. The skin on his face is red and peeling, the scalp blistered, hairless. With a sudden rush, the chair comes free and races onwards in the current. I've always known that chair as something heavy, its rotten wood frame clung with green hessian, matted and spoiled from years of cigarette smoke and television meals. But it appears now light, buoyant. Its charred black shape glides through the water alongside the supermarket until it bumps, spinning past a lamppost on the corner of Geddes Street. Yet through it all he remains asleep. His head bent forward and his shoulders hunched, arms loosely on his lap, as if it is a Christmas afternoon. And I'm struck right then with an awful sadness, or something worse, that here he is for everybody to see, exposed, alone, the giddy babble of the presenter talking about him. Only a short time earlier, he would have been resting in the living room, watching the television, nodding off. And I glimpsed then the TV remote control, deformed and melted onto the armrest. I'll stop there. Thank you.
There you have it, two very different but engaged forms of lyricism and alive and young British writing in the form of these writers. I think we've got about 15 minutes now for questions, and there's a mic going around the audience. Does anybody have a question for either Ross or Nadifa?
Hi, guys. That's great. I was thinking right before you read that, the idea of writing in this class, about a friend of mine named Roy Keezy, who's a writer, and he said that his greatest skill was as a writer was he knew when to give up on a story. And so I wonder, how many short stories do you start before you're like, you lock into one, or is it pretty much if you've started, you're just going to fight it and wrestle it until you win that match?
Well, I'm from Yorkshire, as I say, and I think that kind of answers the question for me. I never abandon anything, even if it's really bad. I'll always keep going at it, which is partly an unhealthy thing that I just do, but it's also that I think that if the idea was good in the first place, or it was enough for you that it brought you to the table, then you can probably make it good. I think for me it's in the ideas stage before I actually put pen to paper that I would probably discard things. And I think that once you've actually written the thing, even if it's not very good and even if it's perhaps not actually completed, there's always going to be something in there that is going to be of value and that you can use. In fact, that story was actually quite a bit longer when I first wrote it. In the first draft, it had this whole other section of this kind of apartheid that happened in this field after this flood. And I realised actually that's a separate story. So I've got that. I've got all those papers, and I'll probably turn it into a separate short story. I don't like to lose things.
I was about to say that I've never given up on anything, and then I remembered two very brief things that I'd started and they hadn't really gone anywhere. And I think the themes that I was interested in looking at through those works, they've fed into my bigger books. So they weren't, I kind of cannibalized the idea and used it in a different way. So I'm not prolific. I'm a very slow writer. So it's very rare that I start something and don't see it through. Yeah.
Hello, thank you both again for your presentations and your readings today and for your work. My question is about your relationship with your fictional characters. And specifically, do they continue to evolve and change in your mind after they've been written? Or do they become static once they're on the page?
It's an interesting question. I think it depends on the character. You have different relationships with different characters. So Jama in Black Mamba Boy is based very closely on my father, and I can't say it is my father because I don't know what my father was like as a 10-year-old. So he's my imagining, but I constantly compare my real father to the character in the book, and they're getting closer. I think they're merging in a way. Well, the second novel, there's one character in particular that I have a particular relationship with. And it's the older woman who's bedbound in her house in Hargeisa as the war breaks out. And I think she's real. I think she exists in like a parallel universe. And she was there, and something kind of, the wall between us fell away and I could see her, and she's still there. And that's quite unusual. I don't know if that will happen again. I can see her now even, and I don't know who she represents to me. I think maybe she's a kind of amalgamation of all the women, the older women that I lost in Somalia, but she definitely feels real.
I think I'm kind of opposite to that, actually. I think my characters don't particularly live in my head when I'm not actually writing. I certainly try to be, again, in a slightly unhealthy way, quite disciplined with my writing and my writing structure and my writing day. And once it hits 6 o'clock or 5:30, if I'm coming back from the library at the moment to give my daughter a bath, I stop thinking about the character and they don't stay in my head. And they really don't, actually. And when I finished writing a novel, I completely stop immediately to think about those characters. What I do, actually, what does linger is, and my novels are quite character-based, actually, like, well, is any novel not? but I think they're particularly single character-based, and so they're very much entering the consciousness of one single character and inhabiting their thoughts and language. But it's sentences, actually, that linger for me. It's language. That's the thing that at the end of the writing day and at the end of writing the novel, it doesn't stop. I keep wanting to construct sentences and make them right and make them better. Yeah.
Here in America recently, there's been a collapse in the opposition to gay marriage and an increasing acceptance. You're writing about a gay football player. One of the things that the media seems to be expecting is for one or another professional athlete to come out of the closet. And especially with football, of course, it means different things in where you are. But still, these men are icons of masculinity. And so their coming out of the closet becomes a particularly significant event in terms of masculine identity. Are you dealing with those issues in these 60,000 words that you've written so far, or not?
No, I'd say yes, definitely. Did you hear, in fact, that we had a play came out about a month ago in the UK, and it was quite interesting and quite telling, I think, that there's been a bit of press since, actually, but there was no great hoo-ha about it, and people have been clamouring for this. Similarly, in the UK, people have been clamouring for this moment for ages, and then finally a player came out and retired at the same time. He was American. I think he's from California, actually, a guy called Robbie Rogers. And everyone was like, who does he play for? Leeds? What, he was on loan at Stevenage? You're not really interested. which is because it's all about sensationalism, and people want a high profile player to come out because it'll be sensational. It's all about individualism, which is exactly why nobody's come out, because they know that there's going to be all this hoo ha about it. I think that it's not likely to. There are gay players in the Football League and in the Premiership in the UK, but probably not as many as perhaps we think there might be, because I think a lot of young players who are gay or who think they're gay or are not quite sure, but they think there's something about them that is different from the other people in the squad, drop out of football because the culture is so it veers between being homophobic and heteronormal, to use that term. Like, you meet footballers and you talk to footballers and they just don't. It's so not what they think should happen that they don't think it exists. They've convinced themselves that it doesn't exist. It's like you know, certain religious communities. It's just, and so this what I've been exploring in the 60,000 words so far is this this young lad who doesn't quite know what is going on with himself, but he knows that he's not like the rest of them, and he's not normal, and he's petrified of that, because that's what they're all petrified of. They don't want to break outside of the circle, because as soon as you step outside of the circle and you're different in whatever way, even if that's just being clever and showing it, then you're in trouble. And often that will take the form of mickey taking, but a lot of the time it's worse, and a lot of the time it's violent. And I've heard plenty of stories already of violence and extreme bullying that takes place, not because a player is gay, but because he's spoken in a language, for example, that is not the accepted one, and it escalates this, and it embeds itself in the youth teams of clubs, and often they're worse, the youth teams, because they want to emulate the first teams, and so they're practicing this kind of bullying, nasty culture.
With an editor's question, and I'm sorry I'm late, you might have covered this, why lyricism might relate best to history right now that we're living through. And then I've switched to a writer's question. Maybe all three of you could participate. I'm a lyric classical dancer, and I see lyricism as a type of heroism. I really feel this when I'm at the best in lyric dancing. Where does your music come from? Maybe you could talk about how you feel about your style, and where does your music come from?
Oh, you guys are looking at me.
You had the editor's question first.
Oh, what was the editor's question?
I guess I would define lyricism as a commingling of an attempt at transcendence and beauty, and that those two things can be the same thing. That's how I mean. If I were to spring together a definite, is that a terrible definition of it?
No, I think it's great. I don't really know what it means, but I like it.
So if that's my working definition for lyricism, then I think you can see you know, John Updike was a very lyrical writer, and he was lyrical about very mundane things, and people living very, you know, ordinary lives in the suburbs. And I think you can think that way about pretty much anything. That every, if you want to be, you know, quasi-religious about it, every moment is a possible moment of transcendence. It just doesn't mean that. I think where it gets difficult is if you mix up transcendent moments with entertaining moments, or you mix up joy with happiness. And now I'm going completely off the plot. But how that affects writing, I think maybe, you know, I think we have a lot of noise in our culture, and there's a lot of things that I think stories are valuable because they're a vessel for things we don't understand. And you can understand them through stories in ways that, you know, statements actually can't help you understand them. So I'm not sure how that would relate to lyricism, but I think we have a desire for stories because they can tell us something and take us out of a moment that feels too noisy.
That's yeah, it. I'd agree. And I think that lyricism as well is like you're trying to capture the fizz and multiplicity and the kind of vibrancy of life. That's what it is. And I think that there was a period of time when actually a lot of literature just seemed to be very sparse and flat and, practical, just almost like lists of actions, lists of behaviours. And I don't really find that appealing. And I love Greek poetry and poetry generally, and that's, I think, that kind of captures something bigger than life.
Yeah, literal way, I suppose, in terms of lyricism and music of writing, I'm very much, part of my enjoyment with writing comes from, as I say, from language, but the bounce and the flow and the rhythm of language, and that's something that I really like, finding the particular music for each different work. It's partly why I'm often drawn to vernacular writing, I think, because each vernacular has its own bounce and flow and rhythm. And in fact, with my last novel, I worked with a voice coach, a drama voice coach, to kind of experiment with how I might best represent that rhythm of Glaswegian. And that was hugely enjoyable. It's not something I think I would do with every book. Well, £90 an hour, I'm not going to do it with every book. But it's, she was really good there, and it enabled me to. It gave me a different angle on thinking about language and thinking about rhythm in a way that I never have attempted before. But it was very enlightening.
And do you listen to music when you're writing?
No.
No.
Do you?
Yeah, all the time.
Do you?
Yeah, I can't really write in silence. I have to edit in silence, but I have to write the first draft in with music. And I think the music definitely seeps into what I'm writing.
Do you speak
the words? Yeah, but normally in languages I don't understand. It has to be in a foreign language. At the moment it's Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, the Pakistani singer. He's incredible.
Hi. I'm curious if you could offer any advice on the revision process. I'm just writing my first story right now, and I've finished what is a very rough first draft, and I feel like there's a lot in there that can be built upon, but I feel really intimidated by how to begin building that and revising it. It almost feels more tempting to just start again. And so I'm just wondering how you're able to maintain maybe the same spontaneity and flow that if you do have with that first draft when you go in to revise.
Well, I think that however you do it, writing is a process of instinct and edit, but the important thing is to keep those things at the right stages. So for me, writing is about trying to release the pressure valves whenever I can, and I do that by having a quite managed process of stages. And so whether it's a novel or a short story, what I'll do is I'll write the entire thing, first draft, but nobody's ever seen those first drafts, and they're longhand and they're shambling and they're a mess, and they're not good, but they're not intended to be good. I kind of use it almost as a, I try and get the, that's where the instinct comes in, and I try and get the flow in there, and I try and get the naturalness in there, and I try and do it as quickly as I can. It takes me years, but that's yeah, I wish it didn't, but it does. But because that's not, I almost use it as like a prompt sheet, in fact, and there's no pressure on that to be good, and that's the importance. And so then I have all of that, I have 100,000, 120,000 words, and I come back to that completed thing, and then I go through it with coloured pens and with what have you, underlining what I think is good, and I pull out, I extract the bits that I think there's some meat there, there's something I can use, it's a sentence, or it's a... or there's a through line of something to do with the plot, or there's a word or a character, whatever. And then I begin again. That's the crucial bit for me with writing. In fact, it's the thing I think that probably enabled me to make a step from before really starting it properly. And then I felt like I really started writing properly when I made that step. The second draft, I start on a fresh page and on the computer. And that second draft is the main thing. That's the novel, that's the short story, and then I'll finish that, and then I'll come back and I'll edit it several times, probably. So, yeah, it's quite a hefty process for me.
It's slightly different for me. I also do a first draft all the way through and then edit, and I have editors, so I have their feedback and their ideas to kind of use and not use if I don't want to, and... reading out loud, I think, is really important. I think that's how you pick up on what's superfluous and what isn't. And I think you begin a novel a certain way and you end it a different way. And it's sometimes about evening out what's changed in the time, in the process. But it's just instinct. I agree. It's just instinct. There's no right or wrong, and you could do lots of edits. And yeah, each time you edit, you'll think, oh God, how did this pass through the first time? And it's just the way it is. I don't think you ever feel fully happy with the edit. I don't know. I don't think I do.
Well, there we are. It just takes a lot of work to wind up here. Sorry, that's the short answer to it. I want to thank Louise and everyone at the library for giving us such a wonderful space to have this conversation, and especially the British Council, who gave us the funding to bring Ross and Adifa out for this romantic Western American holiday and getaway. They're not a couple, believe me. Before you start tweeting.
Felt like being a couple on holiday there, but it's been great. I'm going to go back with all these photos. Here's Nadifa on the beach. Here's Nadifa in the restaurant.
How long has this been going on? Yeah.
British Airways actually called me Mrs. Raisin.
You're done.
I'm going to leave it there. But it is a fabulous issue, and I'm not just saying that because I work there, but I think they have great company there, and it's it will be, you know, what you saw tonight is sort of the tip of the iceberg, and you can do that with 18 other writers by picking up the issue tonight. So please grab a copy and have Ross and Adifa sign it. And I'm sure they'd be happy to sign their books if you have them too. So thank you very much.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.